You're listening to South Florida's Good News Station, WCNO, Palm City.
This is God's plan for redemption, and it's good news.
Welcome to the Religious Liberty Report, a weekly news briefing on religious liberty news, a program hoping to educate, encourage, support, and equip you, our listeners, on important issues of our day, but always approaching the issues from a biblical worldview.
You're tuned into the Religious Liberty Report. My name is Alexander Alfano, reporting in this first week of May, 2024. This past week, celebrating the National Day of Prayer, an annual day of observance designated by the United States Congress to be held on the first Thursday of May. When people are asked to turn to God in prayer and meditation, the president is required by law to sign a proclamation each year encouraging all Americans to pray on the National Day of Prayer. In December 1779, Thomas Jefferson, as governor of Virginia, enacted a day of prayer and thanksgiving for the state of Virginia. The modern law formalizing the annual National Day of Prayer was enacted in 1952 as part of the public reaction to the threats perceived in the Korean War. The constitutionality of the National Day of Prayer was challenged in court by the Freedom From Religious Foundation. The challenge was unsuccessful after an appellate court dismissed the case. We'll cover some First Amendment law today on the Religious Liberty Report. We know that the First Amendment both prevents the government of the United States from privileging one religion over another, and at the same time it protects each and every one of us as American citizens to believe whatever we choose or choose not to believe about what God thinks, what God approves of, or what God blesses. It's what protects our democracy from becoming a theocracy. At the same time, America does not have a state religion. It is a country, nevertheless, deeply shaped by Christian moral truths. We know that our rights come from God and not from government. Religious freedom is a founding principle of our nation, enshrined in the U.S. Constitution. In the First Amendment, religious liberty is the first freedom of the United States. First, not just because it's in the First Amendment, but because it's a logical priority. You see, without freedom of conscience, we have no other liberties. This last several weeks, we've seen universities facing a balancing act and weighing responses to campus protests. Encampments, occupying buildings, demonstrators citing their right to free expression. Protesters on college campuses citing the First Amendment. But many legal scholars believe that those free speech assertions are not as simple as that. Time, place, and manner. Restrictions on free speech. It's important to distinguish, to break down the arguments of free speech and what is happening on U.S. college campuses today. First, you have to understand that there are various factors that go into the actual legal obligations that universities have with regard to their students. On the one hand, obviously, you have the First Amendment. The First Amendment applies differently, however, at private universities from public universities. Interestingly, public universities as arms of government must yield to the First Amendment and how courts interpret it. There shall be no law abridging the freedom of speech or the right of the people peaceably to assemble. Private universities, however, are permitted to set their own standards around speech and protest. The First Amendment suggests that universities generally cannot engage in viewpoint discrimination on college campuses. But this generally only applies in public universities. So in the case of public universities, if a student group invites a speaker and clears the invitation through the proper procedures, fulfilling time, place, and manner restrictions, then anyone has that legal right to speak at a public U.S. university. But the same does not hold true for private universities. There are different legal standards, different legal obligations with regard to viewpoint discrimination on college campuses. And you can see why. Because let's say that you have a Christian university. They have no obligation to bring in, as a professor or speaker, one that is pro-abortion or against traditional Christian values. The same holds true at a Jewish university, which would have no obligation to have professors teaching Islam. Viewpoint discrimination does not apply in the same way to private universities as it does to public universities. So the first line of inquiry would be to determine if it is a public or private university where the protests are taking place. Viewpoint discrimination. But you also have another concern, and that is the question of time, place, and manner restrictions. Time, place, and manner restrictions, legally speaking, suggest that it is completely appropriate to have neutral laws that basically say you're allowed to protest during these hours after requesting the proper permits and authorizations. This doesn't just apply to universities, but also to other public forums. It's why protesters that block highways or access to classrooms, what they're doing is illegal. You actually have to have a permit in order to carry out protests at certain times and in certain places. They're called time, place, and manner restrictions. There are some places and some situations in the U.S. where there's more leeway, broad leeway for speech. For example, in public, in a public park, you can just start speaking your mind on politics, religion, whatever. You'd probably be protected. But even in public parks, there's time, place, and manner restrictions. If you're going to have a mass rally at a public forum, these time, place, and manner restrictions apply. You don't want mass rallies at 2 in the morning with loudspeakers. These are normal, expected restrictions, as long as they're neutral restrictions. Then you have a third consideration with regard to the protests on college campuses, and that's Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It places restrictions on speech at universities. It's a form of anti-discrimination law, guaranteeing that the Education Department of the United States will protect college students so that they can have a right to a place that is free of harassment on the basis of sex, race, or ethnicity. Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, guaranteeing college students the right to an education free of harassment on the basis of sex, race, or ethnicity. Now, obviously, there's a tension between free speech and guaranteeing a place free of harassment. You could see a situation in which universities are trying to strike a balance. For example, it's obvious that you can't have a protest in the middle of a college campus harassing black students as they attempt to get to class, screaming racist slogans. The school would not just have the right to suspend those students and stop the protest, it would have a legal obligation under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. And this applies to all schools in the United States, not just public, but both public and private. Schools have the legal obligation under Title VI to protect and provide all students with a school environment free from discrimination based on race, color, national origin. So again, there are several legal issues at play here regarding these pro-Hamas, you might even say anti-Semitic protests on U.S. college campuses. Add to this that these schools, these universities, public or private, have student codes of conduct, specifically saying and laying out the conduct required or expected from students at that institution. These would include honesty, obeying the law. Well, many of these students protesting across U.S. college campuses are obviously trespassing, in some cases vandalizing, assaulting other students. That's a violation of law, obviously. Student codes of conduct also brought into the equation. First week of May 2024, Florida's heartbeat law took effect on May 1st, protecting unborn children and their mothers, prohibiting abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy. The law, entitled SB 300, entitled Pregnancy and Parenting Support, makes Florida one of the most pro-life states in the nation. Taking effect at midnight on May 1st, Florida joining Georgia and South Carolina and having active 6-week heartbeat protection laws on the books. The law will increase widespread protections in the Southeast, since Florida's other closest neighbors of Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana all have laws that protect unborn babies from the moment of conception. The law's implementation follows the Florida Supreme Court, which recently ruled 6-1 that there is no right to abortion in the Florida Constitution. This decision upheld the state's current 15-week abortion law and allowed the heartbeat law to go into effect on May 1st. The law includes exceptions in cases of rape, incest, human trafficking. The law retains the exceptions from the 15-week law, such as to preserve the life of the mother, fetal abnormalities where the unborn baby is unexpected to survive outside the womb, and to avert a serious risk of substantial and irreversible physical impairment of a major bodily function of the pregnant woman. The 6-week pro-life law, heartbeat law, going into effect in the state of Florida on May 1st, protecting the unborn and their mothers in the state of Florida. Turning the page on the Religious Liberty Report, Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida saying this past week that the state will not comply with the Biden administration's recent expansion of Title IX to include transgender protections for students. Governor DeSantis saying, "We are not going to let Joe Biden try to inject men into women's sports." In addition to threatening Florida's ban on males and female sports, the changes challenge Florida's law restricting bathroom, locker, and shower facilities based on biological sex. The new rules are expected to take effect August 1st. Notwithstanding, in Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis is opposing the changes to Title IX. According to the U.S. Department of Education, Title IX would protect LGBTQ students by clarifying that Title IX's protections against discrimination based on sex apply to discrimination based on sexual orientation, gender identity. An end run, an expansion, an illegal expansion of Title IX's protections focused on sex. Now, seeking to expand the definition of sex to include sexual orientation and gender identity. Governor Ron DeSantis saying that Florida rejects Joe Biden's attempt to rewrite Title IX. The governor goes on to say that we will not comply, we will fight back. We're not going to let Joe Biden try to inject men into women's activities. We're not going to let Joe Biden undermine the rights of parents. And we're not going to let Joe Biden abuse his constitutional authority to try to impose these policies on us here in Florida. In 2021, Governor DeSantis signed a transgender sports bill into law banning transgender female athletes from competing in high school girls and college women's sports teams. Turning the page on the report, we go to the 1st century AD. One of the most evil persons to have ever lived, Nero Claudius Caesar. Born in 37 AD, Nero educated at the feet of the famous philosopher Seneca. Nero murdered his way to the imperial throne, which he occupied from 54 through 68 AD. In 64 AD, a terrible fire broke out in Rome. It was believed by many that Nero deliberately torched the city in order to justify building projects. The fire destroyed approximately 70% of the city and surrounding areas. Many were disgruntled and criticized the emperor, believing he had been complicit in the tragedy. History records that at this point, Nero seized on a plan, seizing on the hostile sentiment towards Christians. Emperor Nero unfolded a plan to blame Christians for the tragedy of the fire in 64 AD. A fierce persecution was launched against the saints in Rome. We don't know for certain from scripture how or even when Christianity came to the capital of the ancient world. It could be that some converting in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost migrated back to their home city and established churches there. Regardless, under Emperor Nero, these first Christians experienced a real test of faith. The Neronian persecution was vicious. What is recorded in Scripture, however, is that Nero was the Caesar to whom Paul, the Apostle Paul, appealed when he was unjustly accused by the Jews and falsely imprisoned. We read this in Acts chapter 25. We read that the apostle was taken to Rome and kept under guard for 2 years before the Caesar finally heard his case. We know this because in Acts 27, verse 24, an angel informs the apostle Paul, "You must stand before Caesar." The great apostle, winning his first appeal, as we trace the chronological data in 1 Timothy, Titus, and then again in 2 Timothy, but later condemned by this malevolent ruler, Nero, beheading Paul and Peter, according to the historian Eusebius. Yet Paul wrote to the Christians in Rome in Romans chapter 13, verse 1, "Let every soul be in subjection to the higher powers." Subject to Nero? Similarly, Peter wrote, "Be subject to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme or unto governors as sent by him." 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 13 and 14. Christians called to be good citizens, regardless of the character or lack thereof of their leaders. The persecution of the saints in the 1st century AD, the Neronian persecutions, the first Christians in the eternal city of Rome. You're tuned into the Religious Liberty Report. Alexander Alfano reporting in this first week of May, 2024. Turning the page on the report, and to our science desk, we have a story regarding the genetic versus the genealogical Adam. That's right, Adam and Eve. Was there a founding human pair at some point in the prehistoric past? A founding human pair from which all humans are descended? Did the Bible mean this literally, that all men and women are descended from an original pair, or is this metaphorical, figurative language? An interesting conversation. From the Science Desk on the Religious Liberty Report. The historicity of Adam and Eve. And the science, the developing science, of population genetics, paleoarchaeology. The question of the existence of a founding human pair. What does science have to say regarding the origins of humanity? There's an argument that the population profile of the human race today exhibits a degree of genetic divergence that could not have come from a single human pair living only a few thousand years ago. Some arguing that the human population that we have today exhibits a degree of genetic divergence that requires it to have evolved or developed or originated much further back than just about 10,000 years ago. On the report, we've been discussing the different views of creationism, young Earth creationism, old Earth creationism, and the hybrids, among the various other views that take from both. We talked about how the Christian faith doesn't stand or fall on your view of creationism or your scientific view of evolution or even on the historicity of Adam and Eve. Many arguing that Christianity is true whatever you do with the historical Adam. Viewing these as kind of side issues and not central to the Christian faith. Others see it quite differently. They do view it as central to the Christian faith, as you would the Incarnation or the Trinity. Some would argue that to deny Adam and Eve as historical persons would present tremendous problem with theology, biblical theology. Others argue that not believing in a historical, literal Adam would undermine our Christian worldview. The doctrine of original sin. For example, if Adam and Eve were purely fictional, then sin could not have entered the human race through these fictional characters. So many biblical scholars believe that a historical Adam is required if you're going to be faithful to the text of Scripture. The consequences of denying a historical Adam are very serious and could undermine your theology. Christ, the Apostle Paul, taught that there was a historical Adam through whom sin came into the world. Jesus, believing in Adam as a historical person, regardless of where you fall on the conversation, it's important that we have the conversation. And this conversation should not just be happening in classrooms or universities, but in churches, Bible studies. We know that too many unbelievers feel that Christianity requires you to check your brain in at the door, and that you can't ask these tough questions. But if we're serious about Bible study, we've got to be serious about reaching people with these tough questions. We better start having these conversations, as hard as it may be. Writer and theologian William Lane Craig addresses these questions in a book, a new book, called The Quest for the Historical Adam. He argues in his book that if Adam is a purely fictional person, the classical doctrine of original sin falls apart. And the doctrine of original sin, he argues, is clearly seen in Genesis 3, Romans 5. Adam, the floodgate, through whom sin entered and spread throughout the human race. If this is right, Mr. Craig argues that Adam has to be a historical person. Mr. William Lane Craig goes on to explore the historical Adam by, quote, pushing Adam and Eve deeply into the remote past, somewhere prior to 750,000 years ago. He goes on to say that by putting them so far in prehistory, it enables one to affirm that every person who has ever lived on this planet is a descendant of this primordial, original human couple, which he takes to be an essential teaching of Genesis chapter 2, as well as the various statements about Adam and Eve in the New Testament. Well, this theory goes against the young earth creationists, who believe that the world was created around 6,000 years ago in 24-hour days, and that a few thousand years ago, there was a worldwide flood exterminating all terrestrial life on earth. Discussing the historical Adam and Eve, were they historical persons, or is the Bible being figurative, metaphorical? And if they were historical, were they the original human couple, or a couple among others? And if Adam and Eve were historical, this would be necessary for sin to have entered the human race through these two original humans. Many arguing that the doctrine of original sin requires a historical Adam and Eve. If it was true for Christ, for Paul, that there was a historical Adam through whom sin came into the world, then it's true for me. You're tuned into the Religious Liberty Report. We've been covering a little bit of politics, a little bit of First Amendment, some local news here in the state of Florida regarding the heartbeat protection bill that has come into law, took effect on May 1st, talking about protests on college campuses, talking about persecution of the faithful in the first century AD under Nero, and ending with the historical Adam, the quest, the search for the historical Adam. Jesus never promised his followers an easy path. In fact, he told his disciples that the world would hate them. He sent them out as sheep among wolves. Jesus' words came true in the lives of his apostles, and they're still coming true today in the lives of his followers around the world. Thank you for joining me on the Religious Liberty Report. We'll be back with you next week. God bless you, and God bless America.
Thank you for tuning in to the Religious Liberty Report, a broadcast intended to help equip churches and ministries on how to remain faithful to our mission in a culture that too often disagrees with our message. Tune in next week.